Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. David Prentice and Dr. Kevin Voss join us here for a few minutes here in this hour to talk about the story you may have seen from the Washington Post, kind of tucked near the back of the paper here. Embryonic stem cells develop mutations, study finds. We'll be talking about that particular new story, or is it a new story at all? And in our ever-changing lineup here, coming up after this conversation at 4:30, Pastor Matt Harrison will join us for just a few minutes. We'll talk about the ongoing relief efforts after Hurricane Katrina. He's Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care. He'll be joining us from somewhere in Louisiana, and that'll be just a very short conversation. Then, about the last 10 minutes of the second hour, there is a bill in the Missouri legislature that would forbid the transportation of minors across state lines to have an abortion. You know how it happens. They come from Missouri to Illinois, where virtually no restriction on abortion is recognized at all in law. We'll be talking about two of the sponsors of this bill, State Representative Jane Cunningham of Chesterfield in the House, and there's also a Senate version sponsored by State Senator John Loudon of Baldwin. We'll be talking with both of them for the last 15 minutes of the second hour. Then we have a sermon review. Pastor Matt Harrison preached, was it yesterday or was it day before yesterday? Yesterday, down in Louisiana to some of the victims of Hurricane Katrina. We'll hear his sermon based on a chapter from the book of Romans. In fact, this is a good sermon. If you just kind of want to understand in a cursory way the book of Romans, you'll want to listen to this. We'll be reviewing that sermon coming up a little bit later. And then in the last 15 minutes, Brad Drew, Pastor Brad Drew of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Metairie, Louisiana, will join us to talk about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina as well. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This story about embryonic stem cell research and the mutations that take place in embryonic stem cells is in the paper this weekend. Dr. David Prentice is Senior Fellow for Life Sciences for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Dr. Prentice, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
And Dr. Kevin Voss also joins us, Director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute. And both Drs. Prentice and Voss will be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis on Friday, November the 11th. Dr. Voss, welcome to you as well.
Hi. First nice to be with you.
First to you, Dr. Prentice, is this new news that embryonic stem cells have a tendency in over time to mutate?
Well, actually, it's not, Todd. There have been a couple of studies out before that suggested that. What they did in this particular study was they followed some of the approved lines and grew them, and as you know, they found that they acquired mutations the longer you grew them. In fact, the mutations that are linked to causing tumors. Now, it's also not necessarily a surprise because we've known for a long time that any cell, the longer you grow it in culture, the more the chance there is for mutations to show up. So it's not necessarily a new story, but we've known also for a long time that embryonic stem cells tend to form tumors. So this may help explain just why that is.
Dr. Voss, what problems does this represent? Well, first of all, why don't you outline for us the ethical problems of embryonic stem cell research in the first place, and then what problems the mutation factor adds into this?
Well, one thing that the press likes to mix up is the difference between embryonic stem cell research and adult stem cell research. And as Christians, we're not opposed to all stem cell research, but there's a big difference between embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells. Adult stem cells, they get from various places in your body. They can get them, one of the most common places is from your bone marrow, for instance. They also get adult stem cells from umbilical cords of newly born babies. And those cells, at least the hope is that those cells can be turned into a certain type of tissue that would help repair, let's say, damage or fix some illnesses that are present in some people, for instance, diabetes. It's hoped that someday that those cells may be able to use to create, so to speak, replacement beta islet pancreas cells to replace the deficient ones in someone's pancreas so they won't have diabetes anymore, or to repair nerve tissue or heart tissue. Now, in embryonic stem cells, where they get the stem cells from is from destroyed embryos, and in some cases the embryos are created from clones or in other places. They are actually just taken from embryos, so-called leftover or unwanted embryos from fertility clinics. And when those embryos are destroyed to make the embryonic stem cells, that, of course, causes a problem for those who believe that a person is a person from the time of conception onwards and not just some time down the road.
Dr. Prentice, to your knowledge, is there a similar problem of mutation for adult stem cells?
Well, as I mentioned, any cell, if you grow it long enough in culture, will start to show up with some sort of problem. And there was a study done a couple of years ago that actually compared not adult stem cells, but just regular adult cells, for example, skin, with embryonic. And, yeah, you did tend to see over a long period of time some of these mutations show up, but they weren't the type, as you saw in embryonic, that caused tumors. Now, the other point here is the spin that you get from that story in the Post is that, well, this means we need fresh human embryonic stem cell lines, which means you're going to have to go destroy more embryos, even create more, whether through fertilization or cloning, just to create new ones because these are all gone bad. Well, that's just not the truth. In fact, nothing could be further from that. I mentioned adult cells. We've grown for a long time in culture. We've known about the mutations, but we also know as part of good practice, as you start to grow cells, you throw a bunch of them back in the freezer. So if a problem does crop up, you can pull some back out of the freezer. And in terms of the presidential approved lines, last year, the National Institutes of Health noted that they had 3,500 frozen samples frozen away. I'm sure they've got even more by now. The other thing in terms of adult stem cells is we usually don't try to grow them for a long period of time in culture. So a patient comes in, for example, with a heart attack, they take out some bone marrow and purify out the adult stem cells, and usually within 1 to 2 days give them back to the patient, inject them into the heart. We have seen repair of that damage, but you're not giving the cells a chance then to form all of these sorts of mutations like you get with the embryonic stem cell.
Now, once in the body, okay, if I'm trying to understand the medicine of it, once in the body, say in the heart, and once the stem cells have developed into, say, heart cells, does the danger of mutation continue after that?
It doesn't seem to, at least certainly not with the adult stem cells. They sort of, it's almost like cell peer pressure, you might say. They find themselves in the heart. They say, I'm going to be a heart cell. They sort of integrate right in with all the rest, and now it's just like one of your other body cells.
Yeah. Yes, and just adding to that, I agree, too. In the studies I've seen, they haven't had trouble with adult stem cells, but they have had quite a few problems with embryonic stem cells turning into cancers in lab rats, for instance, in which they've tried to implant them. So that's not only is there a rejection factor, which is a problem when you take tissue from some other source, but also they've had trouble with mutation and cancers when they've actually tried to use embryonic stem cells for therapy.
Well, then for both of you, beginning with you, Dr. Voss, up to this point, how have you been hearing and responding to the really optimistic projections that the advocates of embryonic stem cell research have been making? I mean, they've been just almost unqualified statements about cures for every manner of disease, even some that aren't even really on the list, including things like Alzheimer's, right around the corner. Within the next decade, if we just are allowed to get money from the government to do this embryonic stem cell research, how have you been hearing that, and how do you react to it?
Well, from a scientific viewpoint, I think they'd have a hard time justifying their unbiased or their biased optimism toward embryonic stem cell research. Adult stem cell research is already being used. And in fact, the last, maybe Dr. Prentice has a more recent figure for this, but the last figure I saw is that there are approximately 70 treatments already in use from adult stem cells, and there are none so far from embryonic stem cells. So if you are going to put money into one type of research and you want to bear fruit as fast as possible, why not put it into the type of research where, that's actually being used today and saving lives versus one that's speculative at most and one there with some inherent dangers, as we see from this study. And just as an aside, you're saying that in the Washington Post that article is buried. Well, actually here in the Milwaukee Journal, it's a front page story. Monday, September 5th, yesterday, it's a front page story, and the reason for that is, of course, the state of Wisconsin has a vested interest in stem cell research because the University of Wisconsin was really one of the first initial places where embryonic stem cell research was done.
Dr. Prentice, how do you respond to the overly optimistic promises made by advocates of embryonic stem cell research?
Well, just like Kevin, if you start looking at the science, you find that the evidence just isn't there and hasn't been there for a long time. In fact, if you look at these stories about embryonic, notice how often they talk about the promise, the potential, the possibility, the hope, and how often they actually mention any evidence. And we're seeing, even among the scientific community, sort of a tempering of that optimism in the last few months. Renowned embryonic stem cell scientists and proponents of that science saying, now look, wait a minute, we have overhyped this, and there's going to be a backlash because it's not going to be around the corner. It may be decades at best before we ever actually treat a patient with embryonic stem cells. Maybe we'll just use them for drug development. Maybe they'll just be a scientific curiosity. So I like to point at the science, and then as Kevin has pointed out, there are thousands of patients who've already benefited from adult stem cell research, and that includes cord blood and placenta. We're seeing these cells treat a wide range of diseases. They work not just in the lab or the animal, but they're working in patients. You know, and if we really cared about the patients and trying to relieve this human suffering, it's the adult stem cells we ought to be really focusing on.
Dr. David Prentice, Senior Fellow for the Life Sciences for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C., is with us as we talk about the new study on embryonic stem cell research and mutations. Dr. Kevin Voss as well is our guest. He's director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute. Both Drs. Prentice and Voss will be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference on Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. For more information on that conference, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find their logo there on our homepage. Click on the link, and you'll get all the information you need. There's a brochure you can download as well for the Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th, here in St. Louis. Not only Dr. Prentice and Dr. Voss, but several other guests from Issues Etc. I should say many other guests from Issues Etc. will be there. And God willing, we will be broadcasting live from that conference as well. Friday, November the 11th, our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Prentice, talk a bit in some more detail about some of those treatments that have already been proven and are making progress using adult stem cells.
Well, a lot of our treatments that we're looking at now come out of years of work with bone marrow, and we used to just kind of think of that as like a whole organ. You need blood and marrow, we just give you more marrow. What we're finding now is that the adult stem cells from marrow and cord blood and even liposuction fat, believe it or not, these adult stem cells can form other tissues. So you're seeing treatments not just for things like cancers and leukemias and anemias, but we mentioned damage to the heart after heart attack. There are probably around 300 patients globally now whose hearts are better, patients who are off the heart transplant list or a recent report out of Japan, a patient off of an artificial heart machine because his heart was better after adult stem cells. We've seen examples in patients, again, not just in the lab rats, but in human beings, of treating symptoms of Parkinson's disease. There's a study, a scientist at Harvard, who has shown that she can reverse the effects of diabetes in animals and now has FDA approval to start treating juvenile diabetes in human patients, growing new bone and new cartilage to repair damage, growing new blood vessels so that patients don't lose their legs from gangrene. I mean, the list just keeps growing for adult stem cells. And again, let's emphasize, this is not just in the lab rats. This is in human patients where we're seeing the success now. with adult stem cells. As Kevin mentioned, you're not seeing that at all with embryonic. No treatments for patients, and in fact, not really even very good results in the animals.
Now, why is it then, Dr. Prentice, that we can read a story, I open up a science magazine, virtually every issue there'll be something about embryonic stem cell research. Newspaper, of course, it's common now to read about it as well. You'll even hear about it in the broadcast media from time to time. But nary a word, very seldom a word, or a distinction made with adult stem cells.
Well, that is a frustration, Todd. In a sense, there's sort of an obsession with embryonic stem cells. You know, theoretically, being able to take one little dish of cells and make any cell you want, I mean, that's a theoretical idea that's very attractive. But the facts are that it's not working, and the adult stem cells are. I think in one sense, it's the controversy that's being fed on here. So embryonic, and because there is a real ethical problem, because you have to destroy a young human life to get embryonic stem cells, it makes more fodder to kind of keep the pot boiling there. The adult stem cells, you don't have to kill anybody to get those cells. They're ethically obtained, and they work, and it's kind of like a yawn in the news.
You mentioned something in passing, Dr. Voss, before when we were talking about the source of the embryos that are used in embryonic stem cell research. And I've noted in our conversations on this program on this subject terms like leftover embryos, surplus embryos, unwanted embryos, or even cases where parents will knowingly donate embryos from in vitro fertilization clinics to research here, privately funded research. What's the ethical problem inherent in this connection?
Well, they say that they will always tout a figure that there's in this country 400,000 so-called unwanted embryos in this country, and that's really is not borne out to be the case. That the figure is actually much less. I think I've seen a figure where there's really almost all of those embryos are actually claimed by the couple, and that there's actually about 5,000 potentially unclaimed embryos in this country. But it's always a problem when you think you're doing good, but then in effect you're causing evil to happen. And so we never we read in Romans 3:8, I believe it is, that we never do evil to cause good. And so even though people think that they're doing good by putting these embryos to good use, because they'll never be used to be implanted into a potential mother, that they think they're at least let us do something good with them. And that's really never an acceptable ethical option for Christians, because we run into an ethical principle that we hold very dear, is that is the fifth commandment, that we have a place a high value on the sanctity of life, and that we believe that the living but unborn are persons in the sight of God from conception. And in Psalm 51:5 we read, surely I was sinful from birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. That God places a high value on human life, and that we're never to use it for our own purposes.
Dr. Prentice, we were talking recently on this subject. I think it was when Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist decided to make, well, not a switch, but to have a kind of timely clarification of his position on the federal funding for embryonic stem cell research.
Right.
We were talking with Wesley Smith, the Discovery Institute, on that subject. And he said, look, while this is all very interesting, the real story is being missed here, and that is the issue of human cloning. Yeah, Senator Frist can say he's all for further funding for embryonic stem cell research where the source is in vitro fertilization embryos. But Wesley said, look, the real issue here is that bridge, another bridge has already been crossed, and that is human cloning for embryos as the source for embryonic stem cells. Talk about that.
Right. And primarily the South Koreans are the ones who've made this advance, if you want to call it that. One clarification for your listeners, they may hear these terms therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning, but they're both the same cloning. You transfer the genetic material from a body cell into an egg, and you start a clone. Now you start an embryo. It's a little hard to get embryonic stem cells without an embryo. South Koreans about a year ago were the first to show that they could create cloned human embryos. They destroyed those embryos to get some cells in the dish. This past May, they announced that they had made an advance. Now, the only advance was about a tenfold increase in efficiency at making cloned human embryos. Now, those embryos could be used for experiments. They could be implanted into a womb as well. So if someone wanted to try and gestate that clone to a live birth. But you know, this whole debate right now over the so-called unwanted or spare embryos, whatever people might label them with, is really sort of a bait and switch. Those who want to do this research have already said in various forums that there won't be enough of those embryos. We're going to have to create them. And by the way, we'd like to do it through this cloning process. So the technical term is somatic cell nuclear transfer, but that's just a fancy way to say cloning. And that is really sort of the crisis stage we're going to be facing and already are facing, that people want to create human life for experiments, and it's not enough just to do it randomly with egg and sperm. They want to do it in a specific way, designing this new individual. You know, whether we're talking about fertilized embryos or cloned embryos or however you get them, we're still talking about a human life that, in a sense, you're just going to use and sacrifice for scientific experiments.
Then finally, Dr. Prentice, realistically, do you expect the story and the stories about the dangers of embryonic stem cells, especially as it regards here in the paper lately, their tendency to mutate, do you expect this to dampen the big promises that are being made by the advocates of embryonic stem cell research?
Probably not significantly or not right away. But as we start to see these pile up and the lack of evidence for embryonic and the continued mounting evidence for the successes of adult, I think it will end up turning the tide. The problem is getting that information out there, successes of adults, as we've said, and, you know, trying to get people to be realistic and look at the facts involving the embryonic, look at the ethics, look at the science, and compare that to the adult stem cells. It's been sold in terms of embryonic very emotionally in terms of treating millions of patients for disease. But the truth is embryonic stem cells are very unlikely to ever treat a human patient. More likely, just as this report notes, they're going to make tumors.
Dr. David Prentice, a senior fellow for the Life Sciences for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much, Dr. Prentice.
Thank you, Todd.
And then Dr. Kevin Voss, director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute, has also been our guest. Both Drs. Prentice and Voss will be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. Dr. Voss, thank you.
You're welcome.
When we come back from this break, we get a live report from Louisiana with Pastor Matt Harrison. Stay tuned for that. He'll be bringing us the latest news in the relief efforts after Hurricane Katrina.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is a place for forming pastors, not just an academic ivory tower.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Leonard Payton, on his experience as a student at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Certainly great Bible teaching. Professors are godly men, and they have time for students. Several professors are deep in pastoral experience. This is a place for forming pastors, not just an academic ivory tower. A well-planned daily chapel program models the conduct of the service. We learn what to do. Fort Wayne has decent schools and lots of strong, unashamedly Lutheran churches. It's been a great place for me and my family.
For more information or to schedule an on-campus visit, call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, 1-800-481-2155, or visit them on the web, www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Last week, the California Senate became the first legislative body in the U.S. to approve gay marriage. It must still pass the state assembly before California becomes a gay marriage state, but already homosexuals are predicting fallout for the entire nation. Terry Phillips tells us why.
Dan Furmansky of the gay activist group Equality Maryland hailed the California Senate's vote as giving gay marriage advocates a big win.
I think it certainly makes the gay community in Maryland more hopeful that we will make more advances here. And I think a lot of folks look to California as being a leader.
California's voters have defined marriage as between a man and a woman, but focus on the families Glenn Stanton sees a new force thwarting the people.
Rather than having an activist court, in some ways we have an activist Senate here, really acting contrary to the will of the people of California.
Scott Lively of the Pro Family Law Center warns the California action is dangerous to American culture.
Any diminution of the standards of protecting the family undermines our ability to function as a nation, as a society.
Lively says Christians must get active to stop same-sex marriage.
When Christians fail to compete for influence in a society, then they leave the rulemaking to be done by people who don't share our values.
The California Assembly is not expected to follow the Senate and pass the bill. Still, homosexual activists believe other legislatures will now be more comfortable in considering gay marriage. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
In 2000, the state passed a referendum barring same-sex marriage, but in March, a judge declared the law unconstitutional. Now, gay activists see California as the state to upend traditional marriage. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Do you want more of God's grace? Village Lutheran Church in Ladue is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Village Lutheran Church is located at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue, www.villagelutheranchurch.org. Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, 314-993-1834.
Was the Book of Mormon given to Joseph Smith by an angel or created from a work of fiction? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is titled, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or look for the cover of Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon on our website, issuesetc.org.
Just finished that conversation with Drs. Prentice and Voss. I will remind you, both of them will be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference coming up here in St. Louis, November the 11th. That's a Friday. You'll want to attend this event. It is going to be here in St. Louis, so it makes it convenient by way of location. Also, it will be gathering together. This is really a who's who of the very best in the bioethics field. It will be gathering together a lot of them, guests here on Issues, etc. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. If you scroll down just a little on our homepage, you'll see the logo for the Image of God Bioethics Conference, and you'll find a couple links there. One of them is a brochure you can use. Just download it right there, and you can use to register and get all the information you need about that conference, issuesetc.org. Pastor Matt Harrison will be joining us here in just a few minutes for a live update from Louisiana. In the meantime, we're going to talk about this bill in the Missouri legislature that would forbid the transportation of minors across state lines to have an abortion, an all-too-common occurrence here on the border of Missouri and Illinois. Joining us is the sponsor of the House version of that bill, State Representative Jane Cunningham of Chesterfield. Representative Cunningham, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the content of this bill, what it would permit, what it would forbid.
All right. It actually has three different parts. The main one that people are focusing on is it provides that no person shall intentionally cause, aid, or assist a minor to obtain an abortion without the consent that Missouri requires. And that consent requirement in Missouri is either one parent, one guardian, or a kind of administrative process. It's a judicial bypass that a judge gives a minor the right to make a decision to have an abortion. That's number one part of the bill.
What about the other parts?
The number two part of the bill is what we term next friend. When a minor, for some reason, cannot get parent or guardian permission or doesn't want to for some reason, and they go for the judicial bypass, they take with them what is called the next friend. And all we do is say that that next friend, that adult that that minor takes with them to the court for this administrative process, cannot be a person who would financially gain from the proposed abortion. In other words, not someone from the abortion clinic or any connection to it. And lastly, the last provision of it would require that abortion providers have clinical privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where the abortion is performed.
I'm curious about that last provision there. Why is that so very important that the doctors or the clinic workers providing the abortion have hospital privileges somewhere nearby?
Well, let me give you an example. There was a young woman who died in the Springfield abortion provider clinic, and she was given too much anesthesia, and she was taken to the hospital in Springfield, but she died. Now, if that abortion provider could have accompanied her to the hospital, been able to be there while the treatment was going on, he knew what he had given her, he knew how it was administered, and could have been very helpful, possibly in keeping that young lady alive. So that's why we want the clinical privileges at a hospital real close by. Right now, the statutes require they have clinical privileges. Most people would assume you'd have them at a hospital close by, but some of them are miles and miles away on the other part of the state. That won't do that young woman any good.
Now, this bill, with its three parts, is it part of the agenda for this special session of the Missouri legislature that started today?
Yes, the three parts that I mentioned to you are part of what we call the governor's call. He has specified specifically what he will accept in this special session, and that bill reflects his call.
All right, let's go back to the first one. Now, it is a requirement of parental notification, not parental assent or permission. Is that correct?
No, right now, the Missouri statute requires parental consent or guardian consent or a judicial bypass. It requires that now. But what this will do is anyone who helps a minor to break that law will be civilly liable to the parents who were supposed to give the consent.
All right.
In other words, the parents, now there is standing for the parents to sue anyone who secretly helps their minor get an abortion by taking them across the state lines.
Joining us as well on this same subject, State Senator John Loudon of Baldwin is with us. He's a sponsor of the Senate version of this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Loudon, welcome to you as well.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
Is there any substantive difference between the Missouri House version and the Missouri Senate version of this bill?
I don't believe so. There was a group that's met in the interim to try to, since the failure of this bill to pass last session, try to work out a bill that Missouri Right to Life and the other pro-life groups, the House, the Senate, Governor, everybody can be on board with. And what they've done is they've taken the bill really to its core, where the bill started at the beginning of session.
Now, I'm curious about the numbers, so let's begin with you, Senator Loudon. What do the numbers look like, as far as you can tell, in favor or against this bill in Missouri?
Well, I tell you, I would be frustrated, except that I'm so optimistic for passage now, but, frustrated we couldn't get it passed before, because the numbers are staggering in favor of it, not just amongst legislators, but also within the population of Missouri. Polling for parental consent law is huge. Everybody agrees that parents should be involved. If your daughter can't get her ears pierced without your permission, why, pray tell, should we should some folks demand she be able to go have an abortion without a parent's consent. So parental consent is very popular here and with the people. It passed the Senate 26-6, and I think it was an equally large margin in the House.
Yeah, it was 122-31. You're right, John.
So we're talking about really just, as you said, staggering percentages that would be in favor of this. What about possible, or I would say perhaps inevitable, court challenges should it pass in this special session? Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, I don't see that being an issue, and we've had some of the best legal minds on this that have worked on it. This bill's been around, I believe 4 or 5 years now, and I don't know how much conversation you had before, but the whole impetus for it is the idea that Illinois is alone amongst its 8 neighboring states in not giving parents this right. And the underlying right of parental consent is a Supreme Court-tested law, and it's very solid and enjoyed by parents in the vast majority of the states. But the problem is we've got a law, and forget the issue is abortion for a second. Whatever law that a state would pass, the lawmakers would give people a right, whatever that right might be. If another state was voiding that right for people, we'd be offended. We'd be up in arms. And that's what we have here. The parents, that sort of silent group out there who's had their rights violated, has no recourse under current law. And this restores parents' rights to be involved in that critical decision.
Representative Cunningham, do we know how big of a problem it is that there are adults transporting minors across, I'm thinking in particular about that state line between Missouri and Illinois, how big of a problem that is at present?
Well, I'm just going to give you some statistics that I just happened to find today. There was a report in a newspaper here that the clinic itself said something like 200 a year were minors, but over 2,000 were coming from Missouri. So when I talk to people on the ground over there who stand and watch the Missouri plates coming in, most of them, they report to me, are coming with young people, not even accompanied by an adult. Now, their statistics from 2003 and 4 from Illinois that required reporting on how many were out state, and actually, I don't have those in front of me, but somebody read them to me today, 800 a year minors from Missouri to Illinois, according to Illinois state statistics.
So that makes, as I have often kind of tongue-in-cheek, but of course it's macabre, to note that that makes Illinois, and I'm a resident of Illinois, that makes one of its exports abortion.
Hmm.
They're exporting abortion to Missouri. Would you see it that way, Senator Loudon?
Oh, yeah, that's an absolutely fair characterization. And worse than that, when I first discovered this issue, there was actually a newspaper article. The Post actually covered it, and it sort of was the first thing that brought it to mind. And at some point I looked in the phone book under abortion and saw not only do they export it, they actually were marketing it. They were running Yellow Pages ads, not only in St. Louis, but all across the state. I'd look, of course, working in Jeff City. I'd pull open a Jeff City phone book. I'd travel to a Springfield that was in their phone book. And there's the advertisement for Hope Clinic. And it says right there, in Illinois, where no parental consent is required. And so that is nothing short by any other measure. They are recruiting, marketing, attempting to sell the fact that you can come to Illinois and violate Missouri law. Now, they've recognized their guilt here, and they've removed it. But the marketing strategy, like so many other marketing strategies, you roll out a big advertising campaign and promote an idea. You spend a lot of money up front, and you don't have to because the word gets out. And that's what they've done. Everybody, all the teenagers know. Hey, by the way, I'm in trouble. Where do I go? Oh, well, you can go to Illinois, where no parental consent is required. I mean, the marketing worked.
Well, I know that the governor of Missouri has called the new session, and to what degree is he enthusiastically behind this bill that would require parental consent and in other ways protect Missouri residents?
Well, Well, I'd say just the fact that he issued the call shows nothing short of enthusiasm. And I really have to say the governor has taken a lead here on trying to get something done. He's taken criticism in a lot of circles, people who say this is a waste of time. And I think it's very, very insulting to say that protecting lives and restoring rights for parents is a waste of time and money.
And finally, Representative Cunningham, how would you respond to, and I'm thinking here in particular, the director of the Hope Clinic in Granite City, who says, look, we are simply providing a legal procedure for teens who have every right to cross state lines into Illinois to get an abortion?
Well, I think they're not honoring the law that Missouri has, and we are just trying to get around them circumventing Missouri's law, because we hold it in high value, the relationship between a parent and child. You are not going to find anyone in this world that cares more about their child than the parent, and that's what we believe in Missouri, and that's what we're trying to protect.
And when, Congressman, woman, should we hear something on this bill?
Tomorrow, there will be a hearing in the House at 3 p.m. tomorrow, and I believe on Thursday morning at 8 in the Senate. Is that correct, John?
Yes, Thursday morning I'll present the bill in the Senate committee, and then we hope to debate it and maybe get it done on Thursday, and that just depends on whether there'll be a Senate filibuster.
Yeah, how big of a possibility is that, Senator?
Well, you know, it's a dangerous thing to predict how a room full of senators will react. And so there are understand, even among the Democrat caucus, nearly half of their members are pro-life and have supported this legislation. So there are only six very liberal Democrats who will oppose this bill, and it's potential, you know, there is a potential that any one of them will decide to go to the mat and fight it. But our leadership, Senator Gibbons, has made it clear that we are going to stay in and debate this bill until we're done with it.
That's State Senator John Loudon of Baldwin, also joining us here in this few minutes, was State Representative Jane Cunningham of Chesterfield. Thank you both for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you.
Pastor Matt Harrison joins us now. He is in Louisiana. He's Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care and has been for the last several days down there in the path of Hurricane Katrina, or I should say the path worn by Hurricane Katrina, engaged in relief efforts there. He joins us for a live update. Matt, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, how you doing? I'm actually in my office in St. Louis right now.
You're back here in town. All right.
Yeah, I got back late last night.
How is it as bad as the news and the television is making it look down there?
Listen, it's far worse than anything you could possibly imagine by seeing it on TV. That's just a fact.
What struck you most in witnessing the devastation of Katrina?
If you were to take a look at a city that looks actually, if you were on, say, the bridge crossing over into St. Louis, just in front of the arch, and you were to behold the entire city ransacked, ravaged, flooded, as far as you could possibly see, with nothing but National Guard troops rolling in by the thousands. If you could imagine homes as far as you could see on the Mississippi coast completely leveled, I mean large coastal homes 3/4 of a mile, that's probably 5, 7, 10 rows of homes leveled, like having been taken apart stick by stick, having everything you own thrown in a bag, shaken up, including your cars, and thrown out on the ground. Entire homes, new homes, completely washed off their foundation. So the foundation is completely clean except for a few bolts sticking up. It is far worse than anything you can imagine, and it was every bit as bad as anything I've seen in Asia with a tsunami.
All right. You also, and I was, we're going to be listening to one of your sermons here and reviewing it here in a few minutes that you preached down there very recently in Louisiana, but you mentioned standing on the shore of Lake Pontchartrain and the sight that met your eyes there. Tell us about that.
Well, the the flood from Pontchartrain swept miles inland, and this huge flood struck all the coastal businesses and fishing homes and shacks and vacation places. It just swept everything in a huge wave, destroying absolutely everything, sweeping up rental trucks and every possible bit of human debris and everything, as I mentioned in the sermon, everything you can imagine in life, especially wood from buildings, and just as a huge wave of debris scattered it as far as you could see.
There was a story that you mentioned last week when we talked to you as you were getting ready to go down to the Katrina site, and you were telling us about a pastor in, I believe, in New Orleans, who was still at the time in his church basement, I believe, with about 70 other individuals. Do you have an update on that?
Yeah, David Goodine came out in our office. Barb Belo was working that problem from the moment we heard about it, and trying to get them on every rescue list possible. There were about 60 people, and that number swelled to as many as 100, I understand, who were trapped, not able to get out because of the marauding gunmen. And we had heard on Thursday that they were okay, they were going to be fine, and then Friday I got a crisis call from Barb Belo about 4 p.m. that they were declining rapidly, that at least one elderly woman was at the point of death, that the others were suffering diarrhea, and they were in a very, very bad way, and they needed to get out now. At that point, I was with Pastor Schmieding, and who has been a saint and a stalwart man of God in this whole wretched circumstance, pastor in Baton Rouge. And he immediately said, we've got to go over to the command center, barreled over to this center, which is just brimming with people, with officials, with media, with National Guard, politicians. He walks right in with his pastoral, or his chaplain, hospital chaplain credentials, and I with my collar, walks right into the control central for the National Guard, and walks right up to the governor, and we were intercepted by the governor's husband and very kindly taken over to the state police. State police then registered this as a high priority, and I immediately then, there was a man from Peace Officer Ministries called Steve Lee, an LCMS pastor who also, in times of disaster, comes and especially looks after police officers and firemen, et cetera, who suffer tragedies. I called him and said, hey, get down there and do everything you can in your police fashion to see what you can affect. He got down on site, got in touch with a sergeant in the National Guard who owned, grabbed hold of the issue. In the meantime, I called the White House. I called Tim Gayline at the White House. He relayed the message to the Domestic Policy Council of the White House, who got the issue to Homeland Security's desk. And within about two and a half hours, I'm told that the people in the basement of the building heard a convoy rumbling up very loudly, and it was a convoy of National Guard, New Orleans City Police, and Louisiana State Police, and they rescued the whole bunch.
That is very good news. And the pastor who was there with those people, has he been able to find some place to land, at least temporarily?
Pastor Goodine has landed, although, you know, it's sort of like, I feel like, you know, we weren't nearly as traumatized as anything like he was or any of the people who have actually been on the front lines in this thing, but as a support role, I felt sort of like the helicopters that plucked people and set them on the highway and then went after some other person. I mean, it's just, this has been absolutely overwhelming. And one thing I noticed after coming from the situation, coming back here and noticing that certain people are calling my office about matters unrelated, and I'm talking to people around the Midwest who say, yeah, well, I don't know, is it really that bad? And I'm frankly, having just come out of it, I'm shocked to hear that. I'm utterly shocked.
And we've got a loss of jobs, and we're talking about, I think I heard this morning, a million people out of work, and that's an estimate. homes, of course, and lives. What is the greatest need, and what can our listeners do now at this point to effect the greatest change and good for those who have been affected by Katrina?
Look, for Christians, for Lutheran Christians in particular, LCMS World Relief is on the front lines distributing goods to people regardless of their religious affiliation, doing a million other things. Give to your charities that you know to do good work. Right now the refugees are heading north. LCMS World Relief has been asked to coordinate the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as the entity which is going to be taking care of the volunteers for a refugee center receiving 2,000 people here probably tomorrow in St. Louis with the Red Cross. And those people are all going to have needs, and there are going to be a lot of special needs with those people. This is by far the worst tragedy the tsunami was so horrid, just horrid. This thing is cataclysmic and really, really beyond comprehension or belief.
Matt, with only 1 minute, and I know that you're very busy at this point, but with less than 1 minute, connecting the message of the cross to the help that is being brought down there, what was your word leaving with those pastors, those people, and all the people affected by Katrina? What word did you leave with them?
It's the word that despite the tragedies, God works through crosses, and the Lord works good things through crosses. He worked good things through his own cross, even when it seemed quite to be something else. And we can see already some of the good things that are working through this cross, but it's going to remain a mystery and hidden as people suffer and suffer loss and pain and sorrow for years to come over this incident.
Pastor Matt Harrison is Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care. Matt, thanks for giving us a few minutes here and for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd.
Folks, you can help support hurricane relief efforts down there by making a donation to LCMS World Relief. Their toll-free number, call this number, 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. Call during this break. 1-888-930-4438. Or you can donate online. Just look for the satellite image of Katrina on our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. All right, when we come back, we've got Hour 3 of Issues, Etc. ahead, and we're going to be hearing from Pastor Matt Harrison again, this time the sermon that he was preaching there yesterday from the location of the Path of Katrina based on, well, broadly on the book of Romans, but when we come back, we'll be reviewing that sermon. Again, the phone number, call during this break, 1-888-930-4438. It's the number for LCMS World Relief to help those who have been devastated by Hurricane Katrina. 1-888-930-4438. Stay tuned. The third hour is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.